Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this week's show we have as a very special guest Mr. Michael Curtis, who is author of the very famous Stonehell Dungeon, contributed to dozens of other old school adventures, and just as of this weekend, he is the brand new director of product development for Dungeon Crawl Classics over at Goodman Games. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here on this wonderful Sunday afternoon. So,
I think this is an exclusive. I think this is the first appearance you've had since the announcement of taking over product development for DCC, right?
It is. In fact, you know, they had Woodward and Bernstein. They wanted to speak with me on Saturday, but I put them off for a little while because I know I promised to be on the show. So, I brought them Tuesday.
We greatly appreciate it. Greatly appreciate it. Oh my goodness!
So we were having a great as usual. We started to have a great conversation before the show that threatened to overrun the show part of the show. So just for starters, thinking about your Stonehell dungeon and the dungeon alphabet that you wrote, now 10 plus years. There was a particular window where people were doing what we call OSR stuff, indie stuff, a little bit before 5th edition D&D really took off. Mm-hmm. Was that a very limited window in which that kind of stuff was possible? Most people now publish for 5th edition, even if you're an indie maker now, right?
I would be in agreement with that, because there was that period, there was like the late aughts where it just seems like there was the OSR blogosphere, because that was, I think 4th edition was still, 4th edition D&D was still out at that point. And some of the old school TSR stuff had just first started appearing on like DriveThru at that point. But there was that period where people who, gamers of a certain age who grew up with the Menser box set or, the Mulvey, the BX set or anything like that, were kind of turned off by like what 3.5 did and what 4th edition did. And they said, well, why can't we play like what we did when we were kids? And then it was kind of like life went on, and you've lost your Menser box set or anything. And it's, if you want to try to get it, it's $100, $150 on eBay. And that's kind of what brought in the retro clone movement, which is everybody like using the SRD to like, okay, well, here's a way to play the way we did at the same time at an affordable price. That's what we saw. Swords and Wizardry, we saw Osric, we saw Labyrinth Lord, and 100,000 other fantasy heartbreakers of everybody who took those things and created their own OSR clone at that point. So yeah.
Yes. I was just looking at my copy of Stonehell, and I see that it's right on the cover says for Labyrinth Lord. Labyrinth Lord was my favorite at that time. That's the one I was using to run stuff around the late aughts. I'm curious, did you look into a bunch of, what brought you to choose Labyrinth Lord at that time, if you remember?
The very first box set that I owned was the Mulvey basic set, the basic, the classic, like maroon box, everything. And that was I played using the Holmes rules, but the first set that I owned was BX. And that has always been kind of my go-to, because there's just enough there that, there's just enough there that it covers basically everything you need to do, but it's still loose enough that you could, right, exactly. So you can still bolt stuff onto it. So I had looked at, I looked at Swords and Wizardry, and I looked at Osric, and Osric was still more like AD&D at that point. But Labyrinth Lord was like the perfect, I didn't really even have to reread the rules. It was just like, I know these, this is now part of my DNA. I know. So, I'm like pre-Bargle.
I think I think I spent a lot of time on my blog in those in that period sort of discovering the surprising differences between Labyrinth Lord and the original BX, because I still had my BX books at the time, and I just kept being surprised, like, oh, wait, that's not... Oh, Labyrinth Lord did what? Okay, oops. I think I even ended up, like, house ruling back several BX-isms back into Labyrinth Lord at that time. But it was definitely good. I feel like a lot of good material got published for Labyrinth Lord. In that period, was the Dungeon Alphabet also pitched against Labyrinth Lord, or was that more?
No. The Dungeon Alphabet originally appeared on my blog at that point, because like everybody at that point, I had a blog, and I originally was decided that I said I needed to take a week off of not blogging. So I said, let me put together this 2 week thing, and I'll publish a couple letters each day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and everything, and then I'll not do anything for 2 weeks. And somewhere in between that 2 weeks, or immediately thereafter, I got an email from Joe Goodman saying, "This is really good. Would you consider developing this into a RPG supplement?" So
awesome.
I took a look, and he looked legit. So I said, "Okay, why not?"
So that was
that's how I
to Goodman.
Yeah.
Wow. Awesome.
Yeah. Joe was keeping an eye on what was going on, in the USR at that point and everything, and he liked the Dungeon Alphabet, and that was he offered me. He said, "All right, you can try this stuff out," and I guess he liked me because now I'm the director of product development. So there you go.
Good job.
Yeah.
Good job.
Awesome.
See, kids, blogging can work out for you too in the indie RPG scene.
When people always ask me, like, how should I get started? How do I break into the industry? And I always just say, get your stuff out there. And it's so much easier now than it was, because you have, like, the DMs Guild, and you have, you can just throw up on, like, drive-through, and, but in 2008, everybody was just kind of networking their blogs together. So now it's like a one-stop shop. Some of the stuff is not so good, but, if your stuff isn't out there, nobody's going to read it. Nobody's going to know what you're doing. So,
So right before the show, both of you and I connected on the fact that when we published things back in 2009, it wasn't even clear that Drive-Thru RPG was going to take off. In fact, there were a couple competitors at the time. Now I can't remember what the company was that they found it. There you go.
RPG Now.
Yep,
and so you and I, Michael, both actually published our stuff on a site called Lulu, which is actually where our stuff still is. So if you want Michael's Stonehell Dungeon, you're going to find it at his lulu.com site. Same for me. And at the time, that was the only place that you could do print on demand when we first made that stuff, right?
Right. That's exactly why I went that way. No, because I wanted people to have the physical copy of it. So.
Yep. Same for me. That was exactly same for me. In retrospect, that wasn't the horse that came out in the lead later on.
Lulu's still there. I mean, people still find me on there. Every month I get a check from Lulu. I'm very happy. Things are working well. As you say, I'm sure I'm leaving money on the table somewhere if I have. But the problem is that that requires effort. See, this is why creative.
Our viewer Joshua is saying that he still gets to Drive-Thru RPG by going to a bookmark for RPG Now, and honestly, I personally like the name better. I actually like the RPG Now. Now was a shorter, clearer name, and I was like, when they combined, I was like, I assumed they were going to call themselves RPG Now, and they went the other way, and I'm like, what? Why? But
it could be worse. Could be Drive Through RPG Now.
Oh my goodness! So, speaking of Stonehell, Michael, Dan and I have some personal history with this dungeon. I've used it multiple times. I've run games explicitly. I ran a campaign explicitly of Stonehell. I've also dropped it sandbox style into my existing world of my campaign. And had players glom onto it and explore parts of it. Now, Dan, you've only played it, is that right?
That's right. So in rather the unusual situation for someone who's normally the always DM, I was in a campaign run by our friend Max, who appears on our show Monday nights, for about 2 years as a player running through Stonehell. And it's interesting because even though you've got the Labyrinth Lord on the cover, we were using the DCC rule set to actually run it. And we had a blast doing it that way. So I actually have to confess, I haven't read Stonehell because I stayed away from it because I was a player all the way through it.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead, Michael.
No, I was going to say, I mean, that's another one of the advantages of going with Labyrinth Lord. I mean, where you have a stat block, which is, you know, a sentence. Mm-hmm. And most of those monsters are quote-unquote classic, you know, fantasy role-playing monsters. It doesn't really matter if you're using, you know, I mean, people are running it using 5th edition these days. And it's just a matter of like, look, there are kobolds in here. I have a 5th edition monster panel that has kobolds in it. You know, I mean, that's really all you need to do to adapt it. So.
I mean, I think one of the things that makes it so easy to do that is the one-page dungeon style that it's written in, and I'm kind of curious to hear you talk a little bit about that, Michael. Like, what made you choose to use that? Do you miss that style? Would you go back and do it again?
Well, sorry. So I was thinking back on this because I knew this question was going to come up. So, mm-hmm. So this is from what I recall. Now, this was 13 years ago, so there may be documentation that proves otherwise. I remember. Rob Bowman, who had a blog at the time, whose name, the name of his blog, of course, escapes me, and he hasn't updated it in a decade, so it doesn't really matter. But Rob Bowman came up with the idea, perhaps, of you could do dungeons by just doing, like, this simple, like, you know, like, write everything on one page. Mm-hmm. And that was absolutely fascinating idea, because, I mean, I look back at some of the stuff that I wrote in the, like, in the 80s, and I was, like, mimicking the TSR format, and that was back in the fluff, you know, like, really, like, if you go look at the Undermountain box set, there's, like, some encounters where, like, one was literally three columns of text. I'm like, oh, no, and I was looking at a way to do it simpler, and I was like, wow, that sounds really good. And then Michael Shorten at the time, who also had a blog, he basically came up with like a one-page dungeon template that had a little box for a map and a little box for wandering monsters and all the rest of that stuff. And I said, this is really cool. So I said, let me give this a shot. And I noticed right off the bat there was no way I was going to be able to do like a true one-page dungeon. So I kind of did what I call the one-sheet dungeon because, you know, it's technically like one page of paper. Yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, right. I discovered that really taught me how to kind of minimalize like what is important to put in dungeon design, and room descriptions, a couple of description adjectives, you know the most important bits of it, and then you throw like a monster stat block in there, and boom, and every DM, every judge, every game master who's going to run it is going to just take that information and utilize it however they're going to do. So it was like such an economy of language. Mm-hmm. And at that point also there was, you know, since it was the old school Renaissance, we were looking back at kind of like the history of like Dungeons and Dragons, and back in the day, like everybody had a mega dungeon. You weren't a real dungeon master unless you had at least like a 10 level, you know, dungeon that you could throw your weekly group into, you know, like, you know, constantly. And I had never really done that, you know, I started playing in 80 and, you know, and this, you know, going through the, you know, the 80s and everything. Like, I mean, I made dungeons, but I never made a huge, you know, dungeon thing. So I said, all right, let me do this. Like, you know, if I'm going to call myself a dungeon master, I must create a masterpiece, you know, it's like, you know, so I said, if I'm going to do a whole dungeon. And there was no way I would have been able to do that using like the format that I was using in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So this is like, hey, I think I could use this one page format and actually do 10 levels of a dungeon. And that's what, so I played around with the idea, and I posted on my blog, like, what is now section 1A, I think it's called the Hell's Antechamber, I think it's been a while since I looked at it, but that was the original kind of proof of concept, and then I just started playing from there, and then I was just like, hey, this can work. And then I was like, okay, so what's the theme of my dungeon, what makes sense, and, you know, the kind of mad wizard thing had been done, you know, like, mm-hmm. 100,000 times, so I didn't want to go that. So I started thinking, it's like, okay, like what really hasn't been done with a dungeon? And then I realized, it's like, why not make it an actual dungeon? I mean, like, a place to put, you know, people who are imprisoned, and that's where, like, the whole concept of Stonehill being this prison that was, you know, very kind of, Escape from New York, you know, like, the prisoners check in, but they don't check out, and they're kind of left to their own, you know, whether to sink or swim on their own. And that was like, that sounds like a good idea. And then just, it just started rolling from there. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. I, yeah. I mean, it always reminds me of, because I think around that period is the same time that started up the, or maybe shortly after, the one-page dungeon contest. And so I was reading a lot of dungeons in that style, and I saw Stonehell come out in one-page dungeon format. And it's really become, honestly, a favorite format of mine. And I think brilliant to combine that with a mega dungeon, because I feel like a lot of people were trying to publish a mega dungeon during that period and failing, because it's just such a massive work. And why not, you know, if you condense it down, really force yourself, I feel like that's must have helped get it out the door, is my theory.
I think so too. And I think it's also, that format is really conducive to when you basically have to game on the fly or with little preparation or anything, where if you have to read something where it's like, okay, I have to read through this entire level and read all the descriptions of what's going on, what happens in this room, what happens in this room, you can like scan, and the format of the dungeon alphabet is you have map on one side, you have like description on the other side, so yep. Everything is kind of player facing, like, you know, GM facing, so you can just look at everything and, you know, like you can literally see what's going to be in the next room while your players are arguing what's going on in the first room, whether they should go left or right or anything. Like, okay, all right, you know, I mean, that's so I find that
really important. That I think that's actually a really important part. Is I find in play, you know, assuming that their players actually have agency and actually have freedom to go in a bunch of different directions, I get surprised, like, oh, they're going down that way. I didn't expect that. And can I find and parse the unexpected room that they're aimed at while they're arguing? Is actually a really key point. That's actually a great point, I think.
Uh-huh. So, our viewer John Miller has asked a question, which I think perhaps better encapsulates the second half of my question of, do you miss it? So he asks, how does your current adventure writing, e.g. for DCC, compare to your work on Stonehell? Have you learned anything, or has your style changed? Or as I would ask, personally, did that experience of writing one-page dungeons influence your style that you use today?
I think that doing the one page dungeon definitely has made me a better designer, to the sense of like, I think I can better kind of break down what's important when I'm doing dungeon design. I mean, as every game designer is, you know, you are either a frustrated writer or an actual writer on the side or anything. So, you know, and many of us grew up reading, you know, Uncle Gary's Purple Prose or anything. So we can't be wordy, you know, and I fall into that from time to time. But I think I would be much worse if I had not, you know, gone through my own kind of personal boot camp with the one-page dungeon. How my own personal design style has changed, I think I'm more prone toward leading toward the interesting and the weird. I think when I was doing Stonehell, I was very much trying to do kind of an old school dungeon, you know, to the point where like orcs were old school orcs and, you know, hobgoblins were old school hobgoblins and such like that and everything. And now as I'm older and it's like, again, it's like, I've kind of done that. So it's like, well, what do we do next? Like, how do we make things different? How do we shake things up? So, you know, so that's why if, like, my stuff was coming through DCC, it's in a lot of ways, it's very different from what I was publishing, you know, when I was writing Stonehell. I think the Croaking Fane, which basically originally began as, like, connected with Stonehell, is the most classic style, like, OSR-type adventure that I have under the DCC line. Everything else has got time-traveling caveman robots. They've got trips to, like, you know, the Plane of Chaos. It's got, you know, like a fantasy Appalachia. You know, it's like, you know, it's always like, okay, what's next? What haven't I done? So it's influenced me, but, like, all in a good way. It gave me a solid foundation upon which to build on, I think, you know.
You know, I've always thought of DCC as really focusing on that weird and unusual. Like, that strikes me classic DCC. And now I'm wondering, did DCC influence you, or did you influence DCC?
I think a little bit of both. Yeah. But a lot of that guidance came from Joe Goodman. Because Joe had basically read his way through most of, like, Appendix N. And again, I think this comes down very much to the 80s, where you have D&D as kind of like being that fad, and, you know, remember, like, you know, the whole Satanic Panic and everything, and TSR was like, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room and everything, like, you know, I mean, And then after a while, like, they start, you start publishing, like, the TSR novels and, you know, like all the tie-in fiction and everything like that. And I enjoyed that at the time. And, you know, I mean, it, some of them are still, there's, you know, there's still good stuff out there today. But I think eventually what you start doing is, like, the snake starts eating its tail. So it's like all, like, you're reading the stuff that TSR is putting out, and then so when you're designing stuff, you're designing the stuff that TSR, that was influenced by the TSR stuff. So it starts getting into this vicious circle where we see, keep saying, like, the same old, largely vanilla kind of, you know, not necessarily uninspired, but, like, just kind of, it's within their safe, within, like, their safe boundaries. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and look at, you know, the Appendix N stuff, and we were kind of talking before show, like, the, you know, the DNA between fantasy and science fiction isn't quite so separate, so it all intertwines and everything. So you do get weirder stuff than you would never normally get, like, reading kind of stuff that was kind of just cranked out in the 80s. And like, the 80s, we saw a lot of really bad fantasy, not just ESR. I mean, there was, like, yeah, I mean, everybody had to have to do a trilogy, and this is just like, oh my god, this is, you know, like, yeah, the Shannara series, just like, I've already read Tolkien, why do I have to read it again, you know, and in a poorer form. So Joe's smart decision of going back and, like, let's go back to the roots of the hobby, and it was like, the roots of the hobby are really, really weird. So that kind of gave us all carte blanche to, like, to kind of break out of that mold. So once we had that permission, then, you know, the gloves were off, and DCC really became, I think DCC became something different than what Joe envisioned, and I think we're all happier because of that. So
how so? How, elaborate on that. In what way do you think that's different?
If you look at, like, well, one thing is, like when DCC first came out, it kind of got lumped in with, like, the retro clone. So it was like, you know, it's like, this was it's using the 3.5 engine to do, you know, kind of classic dungeon. But if you look at it, I mean, I still say that although it's called Dungeon Crawl Classics, it's kind of a misnomer. It's not the best rules to be running. I'm sure we'll get on this, and I've said this before, but I would not run a Mega Dungeon focused campaign using DCC. Because, I mean, there's so much better ways to do it. Like, BX is the great, I mean, it has rules for opening doors and rules for listening and stuff and everything. If you look at DCC, it's got rules for, like, you know, invoking, you know, the host of chaos, and we have an adventure where at first level you go to the plane of chaos and you deal with them. Like, you know, that's a far cry from killing rats and kobolds, you know, like, you know, to make second level. So it's very much has always been like, okay, like, let's, you know, and let's just let's have fun with it, you know. I say to this day, it's like, if anything, that I ran, like, a big campaign over when we were all done with during the COVID the quarantine of last year, and the one thing that I learned from that is that I now have on my actual referee screen, the one that is actual referee screen and not a Yes album cover. and this is my advice for all game masters, no matter what you're running, everything, just, like, right at the top of it where you can see it, it's at eye level all the time, write no boring stuff. And you can use a different S word if you want. That's what I personally have there, because, you know, and, you know, it's like, we're here for fun and everything. And I know there's a whole movement. There are people who do love the verisimilitude of reality that you kind of get in, like, some really immersive games and everything like that. But at the same time, you know, I'm competing with Games of Thrones. I'm competing with, like, all the rest of this, where somebody can sit down and be a passive, you know, get passive entertainment. And I have to bring my A game, and I don't have a budget. You know, I mean, my budget is your imagination. So why be tied down into another, you know, 30x30 room with, you know, 1d6 orcs in it and a treasure chest in it, when I can be, you know, in the acid jungle with psychedelic plants that drip, you know, caustic stuff, and you have, like, mutant gecko creatures who are armed with, like, a hot rod that they stole from a time traveler. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, that's kind of my design philosophy these days.
Awesome.
You know, talking about super weird classic literature settings, like things that have ghouls with transparent skin and stuff like that, our viewer Joe the Lawyer has used the Super Chat feature on YouTube, and we do have that on now. So if you absolutely have a question that you must have us put in front of our guests like Michael Curtis today, please, you know, feel free to use that YouTube super chat to get it to our attention. So Joe is asking, particularly your Lankmar series for DCC, right? And Paul and I have played in games that you designed at least at a convention at one point. And so Joe's asking, and maybe Paul wants to put this on screen if you get a chance.
Yeah, I think I will even add in there, I believe that, so Michael, you and I met at TotalCon, and I believe I actually got to play in like an early play test where you had leaned in and sort of said, you know, don't tell anyone, but we're playing Lankmar.
So Joe's asking, what's next for Lankmar? It's awesome, man, and are you going to ShireCon next weekend to maybe play some Lankmar?
I will answer both those questions. The first question is that we are currently, if you've been following Goodman Games, you know that we have completed the Kickstarter for the Jack Vance Dying Earth series. So that's like the new favorite stepchild right now. I am currently working on Lankmar Phase 2. So we still have the license to do Lankmar stuff and everything. It's just that, you know, we have X amount of writing staff. And a lot of that writing staff is currently, you know, tied up doing Dying Earth. So the idea is I'm doing all the prep work on Lankmar Phase 2. So as soon as Dying Earth gets done, I can get my writing staff back and say, okay, this is what we're gonna do. This is what you're doing. This, you know, and then But there's more Lankmar stuff is down the line. Obviously, I have a great love for Liber's work and everything, and I'm looking forward to what's doing next. You know, it's like I'm actually. I never thought I'd be dealing with Mega Dungeon again, but I am in. I am for Lankmar Phase 2. I'm just figuring out how I'm going to do it. That it's going to be different from Stonehell. So, and it's challenging, but you know, I'm very happy with what I've got so far.
Awesome.
Oh, and I will be at ShireCon next weekend. That was the other part of the question. Yes.
Awesome.
You know, if you're interested in the Dying Earth product that Michael just talked about, just a couple weeks ago, we had Julian Burnick and Bob Brinkman on talking about the Dying Earth box set, actually, which looks like a wonderful product. So you can see more about that in a prior episode.
So.
Excellent.
I'm like the Lankmar guy. That was my, so luckily I was very happy not to have like an ore for in the water for Dying Earth. I've seen what they've produced and they've done amazing work, but I'm very glad I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to shepherd that water. I need you to break after doing Lankmar. And so we'll see. Let's see how that worked out.
We love both of them, and like, I mean, I certainly feel like Fritz Lieber with Lankmar probably wrote the most D&D-ish stories, right, prior to D&D. I feel like they're the most D&D stories that were invented prior to the game form. And our viewer John Miller now is asking, what about a Lankmar Mega Dungeon? Like, what about Quarmall, which of course was the first Lankmar story. What about that as an adventure setting? What about that, Mike?
I'm just going to say, I mentioned the word Lankmar and Mega Dungeon.
all the teasers are getting. Excellent.
You're being cagey. I get it. I understand. It's like a puzzle.
We'll see what happens. There's things I want to do, and if I can put it with a good word with a guy in charge, maybe I'll be able to pull it off. You know, I'm like.
I saw that you, like, while you were working on Lankmar, you actually discovered like a previously unread manuscript by Lieber. How the heck did that happen?
Yeah, that's the advantage of actually going down to like the University of Houston, which has all his papers. I have a degree in archives and records management. I have a master's in library science before I, you know, made a bunch of poor choices that led me to director of product development for DCC. So, when we were doing the initial Lankmar stuff, I found out and said, hey, this is the paperwork down there. And I said, a really cool stretch goal would be for me to go down there and see if we can find anything, you know, to adapt into it. And sure enough, we got that stretch goal and I flew down there and was going through some things. And I said, found this thing. I was like, I know where this is going, but this has never been done. But I've never seen this anywhere before. And I've read a lot of Liber, and I've seen some of his other less known stuff, which is out there and everything. So it's just like, wow. And basically, I was able to take a lot of the stuff that was in that story and write the Land of Eight Cities supplement on it. So there's a lot of material in that which has appeared nowhere else before, and it's technically canon because Liber wrote it, although it was never really published. So I don't know if it was, I believe it was a draft of something that he was working on, and then like ideas changed, because I think a lot of what he was working on ended up into the Swords of Lycbar. But there was stuff in there which it appeared nowhere else. So I was glad to be able to kind of give that kind of, you know, some exposure after, you know, 60 years or however long it had been sitting there. So
fascinating. Now I'm going to share one of these. Like what happened in our game stories, because I was playing at TotalCon in a game of Lycmar actually with our friend Ian McGarty. And the gag was, of course, we were using, you know, DCC rules with the random, you know, spell adjudications, and both Ian and Amy had spellcasters, and I had the good fortune of I was actually getting my spells to succeed over and over, and Ian's wizard was failing first time, second time, third time, fourth time, so he started just shooting things with a crossbow and pretending that that was a spell he was casting. And so we all three of us, everyone at the table started just laughing uproariously at me, my character, and Ian's character arguing with each other about whether he was actually doing any magic at all or not. So I have a really fond memory of being jumped by the Ratmen in a Lycmar adventure and spawning one of our favorite game sessions, honestly.
And Ian, you want to know something? And that sounds like that would be right at home in Liber's writing. I mean, because the one thing that Liber what I've always enjoyed about his writing is that I call, like, the Fafnir Grandmasters are what I call blue-collar heroes. I mean, they're not, I mean, and the, you know, like, a lot of the fantasy heroes are, like, solitary, you know, like, loners, you know, and, but Fafnir Grandmasters, they're partnerships, so you get that repartee back and forth of them. To my dying day, my favorite bit of Liber writing is the introduction to the Swords of Lycmar, which is literally Fafnir the Grandmaster coming back to Lycmar from an adventure that didn't go too well, and everybody they owe money for them is waiting at the gates of Lycmar. And the two of them are going back, they're like, didn't you pay them before we went? It's like, no, I didn't have any money.
That's great.
I'm like, all right, here we go. Let's.
That's awesome. Can you see Fafnir and the Grey Mouser going through Stonehell? Do you think that would fit if someone ran that as a game?
You know, I think they'd get bored. This isn't strange enough. Unless it went really deep. It gets weirder the further you get, but, you know, like, no.
I have a question for you about Stonehell. So I remember buying Stonehell when it first came out, and then there was a gap of time between the first volume and the second volume. And the funny thing is, you know, I'm trying to avoid falling into the same trap Dan did in describing my my sessions. But let's just say that I made up a lot of stuff about the Plated Mage because it was kind of hinted at a little bit in the first book, but not really elaborated on. And then by the time I got the second book, I was like, oh, this is very different from what I made up. How do I completely change that? I'm curious, like, when you were writing it, did you know the entirety? Did you have the whole thing in your head and you just needed to break it up into volumes?
Absolutely no. You know, I was, I, as any writer would say, you're constantly surprised by your own creation. the main reason it got split into two books is because, again, it was kind of what Lulu was able to do at that point. And I know I wanted to get binding and everything. I wanted to have soft cover, and that it was like, I get a certain price point if I limit it to whatever it turned out to be, 120, 130 pages or whatever like that. So it's like, there's no way that I can get all of it in there. And after about five levels plus the kind of the surface level and everything, I was like, I was ready to take a little bit of break from it. I said, I'll come back to it. And that I came back to it like 6 years later, but you know, but I did come back to it. I like finishing stuff like
that. Yeah.
So I knew that you would, cause I knew that I did not want to have like quote unquote drow, but I did want to have some sort of evil subterranean race. So that's why the kind of like the last quadrant of it, you kind of introduce like the bad guys, who's been so long, I don't know. So that's like that final entranceway is kind of into their subterranean lair. I knew we'd kind of go into a, you know, kind of Vault of the Drow type situation from there. And I did know, I had an idea of what was going to be on the 10th level, but it was like kind of like everything in between kind of developed as I went. Yeah.
Fascinating. You know, one thing I wanted to, I just wanted to throw it is at the time, and if one of our viewers, you know, hasn't seen Stonehell, I found a really great quote from our friend of the show, James Malachevsky, at the time when he reviewed Stonehell, and just briefly what he wrote at the time. He said, "In the end, Stonehell Dungeon is probably the best mega dungeon published to date in any form, certainly the best to come out of the old school Renaissance." And, you know, our luminaries in the industry were unable to get their mega dungeons published. So we never saw Gygax's Greyhawk. We only saw Arneson's Blackmoor in the sketchiest of forms or revisions later on. James Mal himself had great challenges getting his mega dungeon out. So it's really fascinating that you're in really rarefied terrain, Michael, is actually having successfully published a mega dungeon, because most people just crash and burn when they try to do that.
I don't know if that sometimes I can be like a dog with a bone when I get something and, you know, I just don't want to give up on it, or I think it was just like, I don't know, I think it happened just at the perfect time in my life where, you know, I had the wherewithal and the interest and the time, and there was just something in the air with the OSR movement at that point that, you know, everything said felt kind of fresh and creative, and there was just such, I mean, the OSR waters got a little, you know, muddied as it further went on, but like in 2008, there was just, it seemed like everybody was just, like at the movement, at the start of every fresh movement, you know, whether it's the OSR or, you know, or the punk scene or the yippies or whatever, there's always that sense of collaboration and like we're all on the same side there. And egos don't get in the way until things get further on. So like this was just the perfect time to be doing this. So I was just like, yeah, okay, I'll throw it out there and we'll see what happens. I certainly did not expect to, you know, like, I didn't expect it to have any sort of impact. I didn't want people to be like, oh my God, this is like the best way to present a dungeon. You know, like this is so, you know, I would love to say like this was all part of my grand plan, but it wasn't. It literally was just, like, I have an idea for a dungeon. I'm going to put it out there. You know, like originally, the first two levels were free on my blog. I mean, you know, and then it wasn't until like somebody was like, Mike, you can probably charge money for this. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I guess I could, you know. I still have the first Verablum is still like $13.99 or something like that. I haven't like adjusted them. It was just cheap as heck. I think that's part of the reason for the popularity too. You know, it's like I can get this for less than $20, and you know. So.
We have all benefited from your lack of business insight, Michael. Oh, thank you.
definitely gotten more than $13.99 worth out of this thing.
But you've gotten better, right? Okay, so you're feeling much better 13, 15 years after that fact, to the point where again we have the great opportunity to talk to you on the weekend, where you were announced to be the brand new Goodman Games Director of Product Development for DCC. So now that you have the steering wheel, how do you plan to redirect DCC's product in the future?
Let's just say is that I'm not going to go crazy. Let's put it this way. Next year will be 10 years of DCC, and DCC has been gifted with one of the best fan bases I have ever encountered in all my life of nerddom. I mean, it is some of the most friendly, most creative people that I have ever had the pleasure of dealing with, both like online and in person and everything. And the last thing I want to do is alienate any of these wonderful people who keep me employed. So it's going to be more of the same in a lot of ways. Don't expect, you know, like a lot of the stuff which you probably it won't really be noticeable. Like we're trying to get things like right now we're trying to get things like codified with kind of like layout, and you know we're going back and we're working with kind of like updating some of the language and everything, because it's been 10 years and mores have changed and we realize that we need to be more inclusive and stuff, so a lot of that is like kind of on the short list of stuff which really has to be done. Obviously we have a bunch of Kickstarters which still need fulfillment, so it's not like I started the job this week, you know, so things are going to change next week. It's more like we have to get a lot of stuff coming out, and, you know, we've still got to fulfill, you know, Crypt of the Devil Lich. We've got the Dungeon Denizens book planned for later this year. It's been announced that we're doing Janelle Jackway's Dark Tower is going to be coming out. So, you know, we're still doing the prep for doing that and everything. So there's a lot of oars in the order. I know what Joe's plans are for the coming years and everything, and I know that the things I want to add to that schedule, but, you know, it's like, you know, it's again, it always comes down to the fact that we have a finite amount of staff, and we have, you know, your ideas are always bigger than what your staffing allows you to do. So we're not Paizo, we're not wizards, so we, you know, it's just like, you know, so and as I say, a lot of my writers right now are currently working on Dying Earth. So it's, you know, so we're expanding kind of our writing base, and we had an open call for editors a couple months back, so we're kind of expanding that base as well. So we're laying a lot of foundation for, you know, soaring higher and better in the future right now. So so nothing's going to be immediately noticeable. And when big things are happening, I am leaving it up to Joe in order to make all those announcements, because I've only been on my job for a week, but I really, really like it. I don't want to lose it.
Well, okay, so I'm going to try here to get Michael to say something that makes Joe on Monday say, I don't know if this is working out, Michael. But we are huge fans of the taste level of yourself and Joe and everybody at DCC. We, you know, we had Janelle J. Quays on as a guest earlier this season talking about her classic Dark Tower and Caverns of Thracia and all such stuff as that. So if anybody wants to see that episode, we had such a great time talking to Janelle, as a matter of fact. So to be clear, you're saying some things need to get tuned a little bit in DCC. Does that mean there's a possibility of a second edition or revised rule book, or is that on the
we do the same thing every time we reprint the rule book. We'll swap out one of the adventures in it, we'll go back in if there's a typo that exchanged, or if there's a typo that snuck in somehow. I think the most recent printing, it was the simplest thing. It's like there was an addition that your luck modifier affects your spell check. And yeah, that technically only comes into play if you have a certain birth sign which does so, but that caused so much confusion. It's like everybody's like, no, your luck sign says that the rules are like, that's not what we, it's not meant it that way. So like one, like the first thing I went through was like, we are removing this, we are never going to speak of this ever again, you know. So there's a lot of stuff like that, you know, the biggest thing that I'm aware of coming into DCC in my role is that because DCC's roots are in Appendix N, which are the literature, you know, Gary Gygax's favorite, famous list of writers that influenced D&D, and most of those writers were writing in the 20s and the 30s and the start and middle of last century, with the exception, I think, two names. They're all male. And there's not a single person of color in that group or anything like that. So it's how do we make DCC? I think it's the same issue that Chaosium has always run into with Call of Cthulhu. I mean, you're producing a game which is based on the work of like Lovecraft, and Lovecraft is not the most forward thinking gentleman whatsoever, but yet Chaosium makes itself very kind of accessible, and it's very popular. I mean, it's like the number one role playing game in Japan. You know, I think if Lovecraft heard that, he would get back into his coffin and bury himself deeper. You know, I mean, so a lot of things it's the same thing. It's like we're a community, we're gamers, and we have to be open. We have to be, anything that is good for gamers at a whole is good for all of us. So yeah. So
we wind up talking about Lovecraft on every single conversation, frankly. Like, there's almost no episode with a guest that goes by that we don't wind up, you know, touching on the HPL, you know, at the root of the pulp literature and the root of the industry ultimately. So it's good to be, you know, cognizant of that. And I mean, he didn't even like Irish people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I mean, I always, you know, it's a hot point issue for a lot of people, but, you know, I always think of Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali famously said, you know, a person who thinks the same way at 50 as they thought when they were 20 has wasted 30 years of their life.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now role-playing games have been around for more than 40 years. So if we're still thinking the same way that, you know, role-playing games, and not even just from design philosophy, I mean, just game design has changed, but, you know, the audience has changed and for the better. I mean, if you went to, like, Gen Con in 1977 and took a look at, like, who was attending the call, guarantee you 99% white men, from the Midwest and everything. You go to Gen Con, I'm going to say 2019, it's clearly that, you know, I mean, fantasy and all this stuff has exploded and it's become mainstream. So we have to, you know, we have to be welcoming to people. No, I mean, that's just the sort of way. I mean, and because we get a lot of the inspiration from Appendix N, which is not the most forward-thinking when it comes to certain things, but it's very forward-thinking in other things. It's just sheer creativity. It's like, how do we take all the good stuff and leave the bad behind and just say, come on, enjoy it, and come on, hang out, play our wacky little game that where you roll dice and, you know, you might blow up an elephant with an ill-cast spell, or, you know, you summon up an angel and, he or she shows up and, you know, hangs out with you for 1d6 rounds because the spell went the way you wanted, or, you know, or your spells don't work, so you suddenly your crossbow is a spell casting. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that's hard.
Here in 2021, we just happen to be having a conversation the week that Gen Con is going to happen, at the end of this week, actually. So unless there was some announcement recently in the last couple hours that I missed, there actually is an in-person Gen Con happening at the end of this week, actually. So good luck to everybody. Good luck to everybody who is traveling there for the in-person Gen Con in September in 2021 here. We hope that as things open up more and get safer in the future, that everybody gets to be involved in our hobby. So I think that's well put.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So since we're in the realm of hot topics, I want to bring up something that is clearly going to erupt into a massive fight between Dan and Michael. Michael, how do you personally feel about the unusual dice in DCC?
I have no qualms about them whatsoever. You know, they're a tool just like everything else, like every other dice.
Does it ever get in the way when you're, like, running stuff at cons to have to be like, yep, there's more dice. You don't have enough dice.
I don't understand the pushback about games like dice. Like, you know, like, oh god, I have to buy more dice. You know, like, who the hell are you? Like, are you serious?
I think I would like to quote my good friend Howard and pointing out the non-Euclidean nature, the breaking of symmetry in the universe is fundamentally a corrupt attack on our mental systems that has a possibility of driving us all insane permanently. So that one, I'm gonna come down and say no. I disagree with that, Mr. Curtis.
Oh man, it's that wonder of see what the problem is you've gotten too old and you're too jaded. Do you remember the magic of when you were a child and you realized that there was a die with 20 sides to pull out of the mind, and now
it's perfectly symmetrical. And it's perfect, and they're all triangles, and they all have perfect symmetry, of which there's only five such platonic solids in the universe, and I loved it. You're right.
It's all good, baby. I mean, you know, if I can blow your mind with a D7, you know, it's like, you know, I can tell, like, oh, we're gonna get along.
Foul things to say about the D7 in particular.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I have a math degree, so I can write a proof on this issue if anybody needs me to. But enough of that. I think we've made our
point. Dan Collins TED Talk after the show where he will be going.
our viewer William Hellman is pointing out that Dan is still having issues with D10s, and I don't forgive the D10s for breaking the symmetry of the dice in D&D. I do agree. Anyway, Mr. Curtis, I 100% respect your insane opinion.
You just have to let it go, man. It's all good. And don't stay up late worrying about probabilities and percentiles and everything. Just roll some dice and have a laugh. That's all my attitude.
That's
Well,
I love when there's new dice coming out. I mean, you know, it's like I bought a Zocchihedron at the last Gen Con I was at. I said I haven't had a Zocchihedron forever. I said Lou was there. I said, "What, Lou Zocchi?" He said, "Lou, I want a golf ball. Let me buy one." You know, so I have it. You know, I would not roll it on a table that didn't have guards on the side to keep it from rolling off. But I got one. You know, I got a D60. I can bring, you can bring your D20 to a dice fight, but, you know, you're going to be outgunned, baby. That's all I'm saying.
I'm going to ask Lou about this.
I will say, I drew the line on that die that came out with supposedly, like, you could roll every sort of die on it whatsoever. It was, like, the one thing, like, it was, like, a Kickstarter, maybe 240. About
240. It was probably, like, a 240.
Like, yeah. Like, a booklet that he had to, you know, like, okay, like, if this symbol comes up, but yeah, I was like, no.
No. I have a friend who runs.
That one actually sort of makes a little bit of sense.
I have a friend who runs DCC at conventions and always brings the sets of dice in egg cartons because there's a perfect number of dice when you use the original polyhedrals plus the DCC ones that they all each one fits in an egg carton and then presumably. You know, if you have to go up or down a step, it's very easy to just go to the next one. Okay, just put it back in this little container, pull out the next one.
I will say that everybody else that I play with is really it has a lot of fun with the non-platonic DCC dice. So I'm clearly a curmudgeon about that. No
about it. So next time at TotalCon and Dan's been playing one of my games, I'm like, oh, sorry, Dan, you have a modifier. You're going to have to roll a D7 for this, and I will make sure that you never roll an actual Euclidean like geometric die the entire day. That's it. look at your other hand. It's just a D24.
I'm looking forward to that because you're going to see what I get to, what I say at the table in a game when I'm not on the show, which is not allowed on the actual program.
Oh dear.
That's awesome. So much creativity in DCC, and it's really great to see that enthusiasm, that creativity come through. You know, I have a really super soft, place in my heart for the DCC rulebook because, as you say, at the time when Joe wrote it initially, he was looking at a bunch of old school blogs, and he's got, in addition to Appendix N, which has, right, the literature that we're looking at, he also added an Appendix O, of online resources, and he put my blog in Appendix O. So I'm really fond of having one little line reference in the DCC rules, which is great. So thanks to Joe for that.
Michael, is there anything else you can tell us coming up on the horizon for you in your new role?
A lot of people have been asking me, will I still be writing? And the answer is yes, I will still be writing. Obviously, my output will probably not be as much as it used to be, but considering I've been on sabbatical for the last 2 years and haven't really been writing anything, I mean, anything is going to be an improvement. It's going to take me a little bit of time to figure out like how much of my day I can, because before I took this, when I was writing, I was doing 2,000 words a day. I don't see that happening anymore, but I'm still going to continue to work on stuff. The advantage of this is that I have a lot more say over what project I do get to work on. So I'm like, hey, that looks fun. I think I want to, I'll put myself later on that, you know, so, you know. But there will still be stuff coming out under the Heartfly line. I'm still going to have a lot of poll doing when we can do Lankmar again. It's going to be very exciting. I am looking forward to it. Working full time in the gaming industry, I feel like I've won the nerd lottery twice now. Like first breaking my way into it, and now kind of being I have a grown up job with like grown up benefits and everything. And you know, it's like yeah. So I am very, especially after the last project which I worked on, where I commuted 80 miles every day, being able to do everything from home, I'll be very happy if my life turns out that I turn to my final deadline and then they just put me in the ground, like right after that, you know, it's just really good for my DCC career. I'm done, you know.
I have said that in the past, Michael, and then I've had friends say, nope, you're going to do that, and then you're going to want more. And you know what? They were right about that. But we're fortunate with what we get to do.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
We are close to our end of time here. So any final thoughts on Stonehell or DCC or any topic?
I'm very proud of Stonehell. I'm glad people are still buying it and everything. I hardly expected this to be the case. I would, you know, when I put it out there, I figured I might sell 50 copies. And here we are, 2021, and you know, people are still buying it. People are still discovering it and everything. So people are playing it on all different systems. And I guess this one page dungeon thing worked out it's almost evergreen. You know, like I don't know what D&D 6 is going to be, but if they have kobolds and orcs in it, theoretically you could run it using Stonehell. So I'm very happy about that.
Great.
That's great. And I would just throw in there, my experience is as a player running through Stonehell, it works great with DCC. Dungeon Crawl Classics is a great system, and we had a blast with that combination. So we've got a link in our YouTube description to get to Michael's Stonehell Dungeon adventure that's on Lulu, and we'll have links to Goodman Games, and of course look for all the other stuff for Goodman Games, the Lankmar adventures that Michael has produced, the Dying Earth box set, and all kinds of cool stuff that's coming up in the future.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely look for that in the description of the video. If you have any feedback, comments, questions about our experience running Stonehell, or what works or what doesn't, or who was the Plated Mage anyway, leave us some comments in the video. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe that will spawn a subsequent episode for us here on Wandering DMs.
Yeah, and of course, remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. Maybe you're new to the show. We are on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook, and also GitHub if you're a coder. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites, so please look for us there, and you'll get updates about new episodes and future guests.
If you prefer to listen to our shows in audio-only podcast format, you can do that. They're available on our website at wanderingdms.com. We got behind a little bit on producing those podcasts, but they've been rolling out for anybody who's been paying attention over the past week, and we're catching up very rapidly. You can also listen to them on third-party carriers such as Google Podcast or iTunes or Spotify. If you're listening to this show on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us on that site. That helps other users find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, our thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DM show. We could not do what we're doing and have great guests like Mr. Michael Curtis here today without your generous support. If you're in a position to join our patrons, please do go to patreon.com/wanderingdms. And again, over the summer, we got a little bit behind on the benefits on that. We released a new breakfast briefing a couple days ago. So if you are a patron and you haven't seen that, please go to Patreon. You'll see our behind-the-scenes video that we released a couple days ago. In addition to that, we do have discounts on merchandise. We have access to our private Discord server that we host live chats immediately after every Sunday show. We'll be there in about 5 or 10 minutes, as a matter of fact. And we try to have monthly behind-the-scenes videos and polls and surveys and our after-party chat in a couple minutes. Upcoming shows this week on Wandering DMs. Paul is back with 10 Dead Rats Monday night, of course. Isabel and I will be back with our D&D war game Saturday after we had a technical glitch last night. A little awkward there. And then we're planning on being back next Sunday for part two, where we wrap up our dungeon design dash, where we try to do a whole one-page dungeon in just like an hour or two. So we'll be looking for that next Sunday. That's the plan, right, Paul?
Yep.
Okay. Michael, thank you enormously for joining us this Sunday. This was a great chat. We really appreciate it. Best of luck with the new position. I hope that goes super, super well. We expect great things out of DCC in the future. Don't forget, viewers, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then. Bye, everyone.